Oh, yeah, so you'll actually just answer Jared's questions, but I get the Doctor Who spoiler sound effect. That's fair.
He does do spoilers to me as well.
I'm just being a petty bitch.
Welcome to the Commentary Track, a Kamen Rider podcast. I'm your host, Jared.
I'm Cody.
And I'm producer, Jed.
How's it going, boys?
Week's been pretty good. Got into an interesting rabbit hole on Reddit, actually, about cosmic horror. Cosmic horror is a big interest of mine. I love H.P. Lovecraft. Well, I love his works, not the problematic individual who wrote them. But cosmic horror has been a big thing for me, and it kind of got me thinking, because this Reddit post made the point that Horton Hears a Who would technically qualify as cosmic horror. It is a race of incredibly tiny beings that access a realm outside of their comprehension, with large, impossibly powerful beings directly deciding their fate, and the decision of their fate not even being a relevant or meaningful part of the other society, just kind of a footnote. So for the Whos, interacting with Horton, that is a cosmic horror story.
My brain is still melted from Masked Rider. I do not have the brain space for this bullshit.
The Lego Movie qualifies too.
You know, when you started talking about that, I was thinking that it was cosmic horror from Horton's point of view, not from the Who's, but oh
yeah,
yeah, you're right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Dr. Seuss.
Yep, let's go.
No, I was gonna try and be like the Grinch Christmas, because it's December, and I want to take a moment and give a special thanks to one of our listeners, Phoenix, who sent us a lovely little Christmas card. And it's got some Kimmy cards and some really cool Kuka stickers, one for each of us.
Yeah, I noticed that. Our fan's name is Phoenix?
Yes.
That's the tag. Cool. I want you to know, Phoenix, that one of those Kuga stickers is going right on our soundboard. So thank you so much. That was a really cool holiday treat to get for us. We very much appreciate it.
And a stupid hot Hiromi postcard.
That was just for you.
That was for you. The Kimmy cards, the Kuga, and that's Mighty Kuga. And I believe this is Ultimate Form, is it not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I didn't know if you'd seen Ultimate Form yet, just because, like, it was a little spoiled for me going to Japan. There were action figures of it.
Like I said, I have watched multiple, like, Kamen Rider form compilation videos. I've seen Ultimate Form. Yeah, I know nothing about it, but I've seen the Henshin into Ultimate Form.
On that note, I do have my newest submission for Will It Grong. So this has actually been more challenging than I anticipated, because I'm trying not to go with super common use animals. Like, we've already seen a rhino, we've seen a wasp, we've seen some very common animals. There are some that you can just assume are going to get one. Like, we haven't seen one yet, but I would bet folding money that there's a scorpion Grongi at some point. Like, there just about has to be. We got a rhino, we're going to get a scorpion. Basically, if it was on the roster for dangerous creatures, it's going to make an appearance. I also don't want to go so obscure that there's, like, no possible way. Like, the shrieking Karakara bird. I bet there's not a Grongi built after that.
The tawny frog mouth.
Don't do that. Don't tawny frog mouth Grongi us. So I think the one I'm going to go with this week, because it is a fairly dangerous and fairly well-known animal, is a lionfish. And I'm going to go with a lionfish because it has a lot of cool potential for aesthetics. You know, lionfish are a very dangerous animal. Their poison is very, very toxic. They destroy whatever ecology they get put into because they're a very aggressive predator species. But something we haven't seen too much of is defensive-orientated Grongi. So the lionfish is a predator, and it's a voracious one, but what makes it really dangerous is that nothing can prey on it. Those spines, like sharks, bull sharks, can die from eating these fish. So a Grongi that uses venom as a defensive tactic, like just imagine if Kuga like threw a kick, hit spikes, and all of a sudden he's poisoned. That would be a really cool aesthetic. So, you know, poisoning, obviously, in some way, either by like spiking somebody or like just actually using poison would be a cool approach. So my submission this week for a Grongi is lionfish.
It has not gronged yet. The description seems to be a May.
Yeah, I could see it as a May.
We have dubbed this Granji, May Makigogi, from the Japanese for lionfish Mino Kasa Go.
Yeah, I just honestly thought lionfish would be a really cool aesthetic for the human, too. You know, lots of cool, like, affectations that we could go with there.
What would the human form look like?
I like to think like a punk rocker, like Liberty Spikes, but, you know, orange because lionfish. Or maybe like white and orange Liberty Spikes. I thought that'd be pretty cool. You know, the spiked wrist gauntlets and spiked belt. Like somebody, you know, they could even have like a guitar on their back or something. But like that would be a really cool aesthetic, I think. Didn't you have one that you came up with just as a like a cool concept piece?
For the whale that we know exists. I just imagine since it's a zoo who would use its body, but Zane had raw strength. So I posit the whale Granji jumped off building and crushed people with his mass.
Yes! Oh, that's spectacular. Just like a big dude. Just
and
like,
that, I mean, we've already established canonically that he is Slamu. So, yes, that's exactly what it did.
Just the people's elbow from the third floor. 100% approve. Just a bunch of flattened people downtown. It's really weird.
They're pancaked. What's going on?
I'm just imagining like the opening footage of that episode. It's some dude just walking down the street with his girlfriend and like all of a sudden they're in shadow, like something's passed overhead, and you just hear
the Granji bounces.
Of course it does.
Splat, bounce, go about business. Move bracelet. All right, Jared, you said you had one. I'm curious.
It's a capybara, Granji.
I'm having trouble picturing it being that menacing, but do go
on. So here's the thing. It is able to get people to lower their defenses and come to him. So I'm actually imagining the human form looking something like a street performer. Oddly cheerful for a Granji. You know, personality-wise, really doesn't sort of match up with them, but it's all a facade. But capybaras are so laid back. They're everyone's friend.
Does it beat people with its iron buttocks?
Isn't that quokkas or something like that?
Producers note, we're both wrong, it's wombats.
It's a different animal. No. So, have you ever pet a capybara?
No, I can't say that I have.
It's like petting a broom or, like, coconut.
So they're, like, wiry, bristly hair.
Yes. A nickname for them is coconut doggies, even though they're rodents.
Sure. Why not?
But my idea is, I think it would be a meh, because it somewhat uses weapons rather than raw strength, a fine mesh of spikes along its body that just rakes across.
Oh, that's unpleasant.
Or it could bring you into an Iron Maiden-like hug.
You'd get cheese grater to death or big squish to death.
Yeah.
Both are unpleasant.
And that's my idea for the capybara Granji.
It's also always just...
That grongs.
It grongs.
It grongs?
There's a capybara grong?
No, it can grong.
Oh, okay. It does grong, meaning there isn't one that do that. Okay.
Okay.
It's just always near water, too.
Yeah.
Like, he's just standing ankle deep in a fountain, just juggling.
You'd go get into a juggling competition.
So what are episodes today,
We are
Jared?
Watching episodes 25 and 26, Wandering and Myself.
Wandering Myself. I think Godai just gets lost in the woods.
Sure, yeah, why not?
Episode 25 and 26 were written by Arakawa Naruhisa and directed by Ishida Hidenori. They were released on July 23rd and 30th, 2000 respectively.
Don't it always seem to go? You don't know what you got till it's gone. It'd be a paradise, put up a fucking line.
A jump to the sky turns to a writer review.
Okay, we're right back in it.
Yeah, we are. All right, so should we just start from the top?
Yeah, let's just get after it.
We open in the Togichi Prefecture at Kazahaya Elementary School, and hey, you remember Mr. Kanzaki? Surprise, he's back.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of excited to see him. I thought he was going to be a throwaway character, but it's nice to see him come back.
Yeah, that's absolutely what I was assuming. But we start with Mr. Kanzaki in the teacher's office looking over an essay that one of his students wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And another teacher, guess he's a gym teacher because he has a whistle around his neck.
He's definitely the gym coach.
Comes over and is like, what are you doing, Mr. Kanzaki? And he's like, well, I asked the children to write an essay about their future. And the gym coach is like, that sounds intense. I should learn from you. And they look over this one student's essay and is like, oh, wow, that's really put together. Yeah, makes sense for him. And Kanzaki goes, but I'm concerned. And at the end of the essay, it looks like something has been written and then erased.
Like, but I don't know for sure. Something it's, like that.
Yeah, but I but I'm not certain. I don't feel like I belong.
Yeah.
And Mr. Kanzaki is concerned about this.
Which, kudos to him. Like, his interactions with Godai really revitalized him as a teacher, like as an educating professional. Yeah. He has a lot. He cares about this kid.
We get the opening credits. We then cut to
America's Got Talent.
Yeah, it's what it feels like. It's although it's ankle deep in water and it looks like there might be some stones to stand on and there's stars or something in the background projecting light. We see it's Baruba and yeah, she looks like she's about to start like her idol concert.
Yep, yep, yep.
And then,
yeah,
bunch of people show up.
These are, in order of appearance, Go Gadalba, Go Zazaluba, Go Bimiyugi, Go Gamego Ray, and Go Jalizida. Along with Bada and Buuro, these make up all but three of the Go.
So, yeah, we're introduced to pretty much the entire Go group.
Yeah, the whole upper echelon is here.
You know, they've all got
oh, plus something. Father Jose.
Yeah. How kind of them to let Goma be there.
And nobody hits him the whole scene.
He didn't get hit in this episode.
He looked surprised by that, honestly.
Now that I think about it, I'm surprised too.
Yeah. He didn't speak.
He even gets thanked.
Yeah, that was a Gadolba? Yeah. Has epaulets.
Yeah. The modern major general.
Yeah. Gadolba thanks Gomagoo.
A little it's odd.
Crazy.
This is not behavior we've seen so far.
Yeah. Baraba,
Baraba
asks, oh, hey, I see Burrow's not here. When's he showing up? And wouldn't you know it, you hear wings flapping.
And bird person and shows up.
Burrogu lands, transforms back into his human form.
He got a little cape.
And he walks up to Doldogu and says, I intend to take them out 9 at a time. I think 23 groups will be good.
Mm-hmm.
Which, real quick, if you do the math, 23 times 9 means that he's going for 207 kills.
270 kills, 9 at a time.
No, 207, not 70.
207 kills, 9 at a time.
Yes. Got it. And Baruba and Doldo seem to accept these terms.
He also says, I never miss.
Yes.
You know, predictions and what have you as we go forward with this. Like, the contracts that they sign themselves up for are very important to how they finish the game. So I'm wondering if we'll see potentially later on, like, him fail to get his 9 kills and that be part of, like, a game-breaking contract. It's just a curiosity to me, like, how binding the things they say during their game agreement tend to be.
That would be very interesting to actually witness a Garongi fail at yeah. the game versus just...
We've heard about it.
...one of the rat twins off-screened.
Mm-hmm.
We cut back to the elementary school. Mr. Kanzaki is talking to his class saying, you know, hey, school's about to end, you're going to go on summer break. Don't forget your homework, but also be careful about the ULFs. Nothing has happened in our prefecture, but, you know, especially if you're going to be near Tokyo, please be careful. There's a reason that ULF safety is the first thing on this handout I have given you.
Yeah, we are at the level of saturation in terms of Grongi kills that we now have school handouts advising safety tips for unidentified life forms.
Yes. And we go through the whole thing of the students rising, bowing, class is over. And there's one student who is conspicuously wearing all black and his head is kind of, well, he's not wearing all black, he's got jeans, but his shirt is black. And his head's kind of hanging down as they go through the whole thing. And this is
Kirishima Hikaru is portrayed by Kimura Takato.
And Hikaru comes up and briefly talks with Mr. Kanzaki, and Mr. Kanzaki's like, hey, you know, are you everything okay? He's like, yeah, why wouldn't it be? Well, I read your essay, and...
I thought it was shit.
Did you maybe want to say something and decide not to? This is really good of Mr. Kanzaki being a concerned teacher and trying to get Kirishima to bring it up himself.
Mm-hmm.
And Kirishima's like, no, you're probably busy. I'm going to go. Bye. We cut to Jonin. And there's nothing on top of the computer this time.
No piggies, no books.
No bunnies, no birds, nothing. And Godai is there, and he's having a brief talk with Sakurako, and brings up that while he figured out the tingles to make Titan form turn into Rising Titan, he's pretty sure that he can do the same thing for all of the other forms, but he hasn't had a chance yet. A thing that I did leave out for Mr. Kanzaki and Kirishima's talk is that they bring up that there has not been a ULF attack in a month. So we have had another time skip.
Yeah, this makes me feel like Godai is probably ADHD, because he can accomplish anything if it is urgent or interesting. It's currently neither urgent nor interesting because there are no ULFs to fight, so he hasn't done it.
Yeah. And Sakura's like, I'm just glad you're okay. We then cut to a train station, and wouldn't you know it, Yukiru is walking around looking at the maps of train routes.
Yep, that's right, ladies and gentlemen. We are going to follow another child as they aimlessly wander through the Japan Transit System.
This is insane that it has happened twice in this
25
show.
25 episodes, yes.
Fire a nickel for every time
an episode appeared in this show about a child morosely wandering while a flying monster attacked from the sky and was killed by a Pegasus form.
I'd have two nickels, which isn't a lot, but it's weird that it happened twice, right?
However, this one does give you, if you watch closely, a pretty good tutorial on how to use Tokyo's train system.
But Hikaru looks up and he's looking to get a subway ticket to Tokyo. And he purchases one, and we get to see him walk through the turnstile. We cut to the Kadoshika Ward, and Doldo is just walking amongst the people. He's holding the abacus. You'd think people would notice, but then again, no one really paid attention to Garima Ba walking around with her scythe, so...
That is a valid point. You know, everybody's too polite to point out the weird guy with the abacus or the lady with the monster scythe.
And all of a sudden, people just drop to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And up above, we get a brief shot of...
Go Burogu is played by Takao Koichi. Buro comes from Fukuro, the Japanese word for owl.
Oh.
We were wrong?
Apparently.
It's never happened before. Don't laugh.
So, we totally thought he was like a falcon or
something.
Assuming,
yeah, falcon or hawk for sure. Nope.
Okay, owl. So he's an owl.
Hmm.
From there, we cut to the joint task force. And a bunch of people are already there. Then Sugita runs in, apologizing for being late, and a few other people come in. And now the meeting can finally begin. And... there's a discussion about how over the last 3 weeks, the police's attempts to track Goma haven't borne fruit, that they seem to have just, the trail's gone cold.
Mm-hmm.
But more concerning than that, they also captured footage of something, and we get just a camera over one of the subway lines, and Buro flies across it. And they say, from what we can tell, looks to be about 2 meters tall.
It's pretty freaking tall.
6.5 feet.
Okay. That's
tall.
Pretty tall. That was one of the things that was notable in Japan when we were over there, is that I, with my 5'9.5", 5'10" on a good day self, felt pretty tall as baseline compared to the people around me. 6'5" is pretty tall.
It's about Space Marine height, isn't it?
Oh, just under, yeah.
Oh, we're going to have fun in Ryuki. I will not explain further.
Jetty, how tall are you?
6'3".
So this is almost the equivalent of, like, Jetty in a bird costume with a blowpipe just hanging out in the tree outside your window. It's a pretty intimidating silhouette.
Can you get a bird costume?
I can get you. I have a blowpipe. Halloween's going to be awesome this year, guys.
Of course you have a blowpipe.
Yeah, I've been to a flea market.
They make a note that it is concerning that, unlike Gomagoo and Vagus Ba, this particular Gorongi does not give off a hypersonic signature, so they don't have a way of tracking him. And that if he attacks from the air, that's going to be a problem for them.
Yeah, the implication there is that Father Jose, as he was flying back and forth, was just bat screaming constantly.
I mean, echolocation, bats do that.
I just like to think he just...
I know, you like the idea that he banshee propels himself.
Yeah, it's spectacular.
Suddenly, Nozomi runs in and informs that they're getting reports from local precinct police all over the city of people just suddenly collapsing. And she says that a group was taken to a local hospital, 9 of them, and that they all died at the exact same time, all from heart attacks.
Yeah, which is interesting.
And you can see it on the faces of everyone there in the task force. The police are overwhelmed. They don't know what to do. They're at a complete loss. And that brings us to this week's Tropasatsu.
Here we go.
Police are useless. So, for a variety of reasons, cops in fiction rarely get the job done. You know, it could depend on all sorts of factors, but largely it tends to come down to the creators' views and opinions on law enforcement. Sometimes it's sympathetic, sometimes it is a scathing indictment. Mostly happens because in fiction, you know, unless the main character is a cop, police showing up and being helpful undermines the entire point of it. You need your vigilante, amateur, sleuth, costumed hero to be the one to do the job. While the name of the trope is police are useless, it's not necessarily reserved exclusively for cops, but anyone who is in a position where their job is protecting people or foiling wrongdoers can fall into this trope.
It could be anything from, you know, even as simple as bureaucratic incompetence, like there's just too much red tape for them to get involved, jurisdictional problems. There's 1,000 ways to justify this, conflicts of interest, but you're absolutely correct. Our main character has to be useful, and if the police can solve the problem without them, we do not have a reason to invest in that character's story.
So, you know, you'll often get cops going after the wrong guys, corruption in the force, prejudice, laziness, underfunded, overworked, all sorts of things, straight up incompetence. Like you were saying, there's so many factors that can go into this trope. Kuga, however, kind of surprisingly subverts this trope, because yes, the cops are useless, but it's because they're dealing with an enemy that is entirely beyond their scope.
Yep.
But they're still trying their best to do something. They're not giving up. They're not being like, well, it's all on number 4. You know, we've got Inakita creating various war crimes to try and give them a chance of fighting, since we know that regular bullets do nothing. But they've come up with tracking technology. They're the ones informing the public. While they can't confront the Gorongi, they are doing a great job of protecting civilians. Remember with Galma Ray, they completely evacuated entire areas to ensure no civilian loss of life.
Even the technology that our main character using is predominantly coming from the police. The Titan Sword is generally derived from the control handle, the Tri-Chaser. And the Tri-Chaser itself was a borrowed piece of military tech.
Yeah,
police tech, yes. I guess.
Every time we have gone into Pegasus form, the bow gun is Ichijo's gun.
Gotta use boyfriend gun.
Yes.
The cops are useless in a head-on fight right now, but work very well as support for Godai.
Yes. So we cut back to the train, and Hikaru is sitting there, and have you ever ridden the Hogwarts Express attraction at Universal Orlando?
I have.
You know how there it's just like you'll get one scene and then you'll like go through a tunnel or something like that and it's a whole new setting?
Mm-hmm.
The show does that.
I didn't notice.
Oh, I picked up on that immediately, that I'm like, the scenery that he's seeing is doing these transitions to show a rapid how far he has gone.
Okay, that's a cool way to do that. That's interesting. Okay, I'm going to have to pay attention to that in the future.
But from there, we cut to Pol Pol. And Godai is outside, and it looks like he's been grocery shopping.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets a call from Ichijo over the bike saying, hey, we found a new ULF. We can't track him yet. We don't know where he is or what his plan is. But, you know, when I call you, will you be ready? And Gota's like, yeah, absolutely. Camera cuts inside Popol, and Nana, with the most like frustrated, bored look on her face, is scrubbing the same spot of counter over and over again.
They haven't had a customer in 6 days, Jared.
I guess. Godai comes in, and Nana's immediately mad at him. And Godai rightfully is like, what did I do? It's just not that into you. And she says that he spent too much time at the lab. Who could say? We didn't actually see him go to a lab. Mm-hmm. But Nana turns around, Pops, seeing her, also then turns around. I don't think he's actually mad. I think he just likes to be involved in things.
He's now just mirroring.
And Godai says, well, how about I give you these as an apology?
And pulls out belt buckles.
Kuga-branded belt buckles.
That he made himself.
We do not get to find out what skill this is. But Nana loves it. Pops looks at this. Godai points to the one that he's wearing.
That Nana takes the opportunity to get 6 inches from his crotch to stare at.
Yes.
Please step away from the gay man's dick.
And Pops holds the belt buckle up to his head and goes, I think it'd look better here.
You know, it just might.
The phone rings. They pick it up. Oh, hey, Godai, it's for you. And it's Mr. Kanzaki. And he's currently at the Utsunoyomiya. He's at a train station.
Do not edit that out.
And he asks Godai if there's a ULF right now. And Godai's like, well, actually, yes, there is. Why do you ask? And Mr. Kanzaki brings up Kirishima. And we start to learn a bit of Kirishima's backstory. That Kanzaki explains the essay. That Kirishima is probably going to Tokyo because his parents aren't around. And his grandparents used to live there. Until some sort of legal issue happened and their house was destroyed.
Yeah, it's now like a little 6-car parking lot.
They paved his paradise and put up a parking lot.
Oh, damn you.
I think Cody just got why that was this week's theme song.
Yes.
We here at the commentary track do not openly endorse paving paradise and putting up any kind of parking structure, be it a lot, garage, or, you know, stately, one of those, what are they called, where it's got like the, like you pull your car up and they put it in like the Ferris wheel and store it for later and then they call it back down. Car vending machine.
Carvana? They use that system. I have no idea. But Mr. Kanzaki expresses all of this to Godai and goes like, I'll do my best to try and find him. And we see in Taito Ward that Kirishima is walking down the street, gets to the spot where his grandparents' house used to be. And yes, there is like a 6-car parking lot there. And he just sort of stares morosely. We then cut to Godai on the bike driving through. We get a beautiful overhead shot of the city real quick. Then we have Buro. And he pulls the blowpipe up. We cut down to a street-level view, and oh, there's Doldo again. And a bunch of people at the same time, hands to their neck like they just got bit by a mosquito.
Mm-hmm.
And they walk a little bit and collapse. And we see Doldo moving beads on the abacus. So it seems like he counts their kills for them?
Yeah, I'm wondering if that's like a go status thing.
That would seem to be, because the zoo and the meh have all had the bracelets that they count themselves. We see his wrist. He does not have a bracelet.
Correct.
Look at you guys catching the small details.
The abacus is like 3 foot by 2 foot. It's hard to miss.
I'm so proud.
Thank you. We cut back to Taito Ward. Hikaru is walking down a street and he briefly stops in a shop and he takes out a
ice cream bar.
Yeah, it looks like an ice cream, and he goes up to pay for it, and a young woman comes out, and she tells him, hey, it'll be 60 yen. And as he's paying for it, he goes, what happened to the old woman who used to work here? And she responds in the coldest way possible. Oh, grandma? Oh, she's in a home now. this kid is far too young to be having this everything I knew is gone. You can't go home.
Traumatize early. Get it out of the way.
Mm.
That's one method of child rearing. The commentary track does not condone purposefully traumatizing your children.
Thank you.
Yours or other, you know.
So we get to Godai on the bike. Ichijo calls, says that they've found the ULF. Ask where Godai is. Godai says, I'm here. Where do I need to go? Ichijo says, we're going to engage him with a helicopter and get to this location. He henshins into dragon form. And at first I was confused because why are we fighting a flying monster with dragon form?
Has the mad uppies, Jerry.
Yes, I forgot about that. So he uses that to jump to the roof of the building. We see Ichijo is in a large helicopter. And right as he is about to open the door to toss the gun down to Godai, some things ping off the door. And Buro is there and is actually being proactive.
Yeah, every time Godai goes to like try and transform, like you see him do the hand signal and just a bunch of pings go off around him. Which raises the interesting assumption that that's a fully automatic blowgun. He's not loading darts one at a time because we see like 5-6 impacts at a time. Like we see a bunch of glass chip the view screen of the helicopter, and it's a line of like 6. Ding, 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 ding.
I think Buro should on the windshield.
Shit's so aggressive it can crack glass. It's me after Taco Bell.
Oh, something just clicked for me. He's not using darts or arrows. He's an owl. Owl pellets.
No. No, you're not telling me he's shitting in his hand and then just blowpiping it in rapid speed.
No, owl pellets, when they eat like mice and stuff, they end up coughing back up bits that they can't digest.
So this is just a constant stream of moderate regurgitation through blowpipe?
Yes, I'm guessing. Well, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the show will tell us. Who can say? But that's my guess. That would explain the not need to reload and how he can do something that fast. He's just vomiting up things.
Would explain why we haven't seen a squirrel in several episodes.
Godai finally gets the gun, transforms into Pegasus mode. The electricity sparks off. The bow gun turns into a Vikavolt.
Yeah, it turns into that Nerf gun that Toys R Us was sued for selling.
He's now in rising Pegasus form.
Its outstanding points are, of course, its senses. But I can't find specifics on the stats for them. It has punching power of 1.5 tons, kicking power of 4.5 tons, jump height of 20 meters and can run 100 m per 5.2 seconds. Rising Bowgun and Rising Blast Pegasus are the weapon and finisher.
And so right as Godai pulls back to go into the Rising Pegasus finisher, his arm and his ankle blow out.
Yeah, bird person goes absolutely the fuck not.
And this is a shockingly visceral thing. Like, you see blood and gore come out of his arm, and he collapses. And I don't know if you noticed, but they showed on his leg that got hit, both sides of the thigh and into his calf.
Yeah, it's a straight through and through. Which is rather impressive damage on a being like Kuga. We've seen Kuga take some pretty hard hits and some pretty aggressive, you know, damage from other people. This is the first time we've seen him just shot through.
And he collapses. And that's the end of the episode. I say we just get into the next one to see what happens.
Yes, please. We got a cliffhanger. Let's go. And we're back, ladies and gentlemen.
We are.
I like where we're headed with this series. Like, there was a lot of dynamism. We're moving through the new form transitions pretty quickly. We're starting to see some more developed Grungy. I like it. Want to take us from the top?
So, episode starts back on the rooftop. We see Godai once again go into Pegasus, switch into Rising Pegasus, draw the bowgun back, and get shot through the arm and the leg. And it's just as visceral as it was the last time.
Oh, yeah. He manages to get off a couple of shots before he goes down. He
collapses to the ground, and while there, brings the bowgun back up, draws, fires. We see that this one now shoots multiple shots instead of just one, and they look to be, like, spikes, rails, something.
Yeah.
and one goes through Burrow's wing, and he starts to go down, and he rips his own wing off.
Yeah, to prevent his own demise, because the symbol starts to glow, it starts to crack, it starts to spread.
Yeah.
And he rips his own wing off as he plummets through the air to prevent his own destruction. That was cool.
It was also, like, just as gory as the shot going through Godai's arm and leg. It's
Yeah, we got practical effects gore. Yeah. This is a new tradition for people in this series, be they villain, hero, or bystander, of actively doing something to prevent your own demise.
It started with Sakurako last time.
Yep, so we got a hero doing it, now we've got a villain doing it.
We get the opening credits. We then cut to Shinjuku, Godai, and Ichijo are in an elevator, and we see a very noticeable scab mm-hmm. on Godai's arm.
He got shot through. It's a pretty noticeable scab.
And Ichijo is concerned, and Godai's like, no, I'm all better now. But he does bring up that he switched back to growing form after getting shot through. And he tells Ichijo, hey, there's this kid, my old teacher, Mr. Kanzaki's concerned about him. I told him that I'd go try and find him. Do you mind if I do that? And Ichijo's like, well, you switched back to growing form, which means you're not going to be able to transform for 2 hours. Go for it.
You have 2 hours to hunt the child. Go.
I am shocked by the continuity in this show. The fact that they remembered Jean's plums, they remembered Mr. Kanzaki was a character, they remember the time limit on if he ends up back in growing form.
Yeah, they're taking away our ability to take the show apart, because if they're consistent with their stuff, where are the flaws we're here to point out?
Yeah. How dare they have such a put-together product? Actually, we're really enjoying it. Please keep this up.
Yeah.
We cut back to Hikaru, and he is staring at a laundromat. And he seems distraught about this, and it seems odd to be distraught about a laundromat, but he walks towards the side of the building, and we see on the other side of the facade that this used to be a model shop. And in fact, he sees in the window a Gundam model kit that he himself built. His name's on a plaque in front of it.
Jared, what Gundam is this?
I think it's the V2 from Victory Gundam. I'm not 100% certain because they don't linger on it long enough. I am positive this is from Victory Gundam. I'm just not sure which one it is. I think it's V2.
Oh, you did look it up?
Oh, I got it right. It is V2.
Damn. That's impressive. To my chagrin, I didn't recognize that particular Gundam frame. Kudos.
As this is happening, we cut to a train, and Mr. Kanzaki is sitting on there. He's heading to Tokyo. We cut to Polpol, and Pops and Nana are sitting there fanning themselves, complaining about how hot it is. And Nana's like, we should go buy stuff for the beach. And Pops is like, that's a great idea. Let's go. Wait, no, that's stupid. Who's going to watch the restaurant if we're gone? Nan's like, well, maybe Minori will show up and she can watch it for us. And Pops like, we're not going to get that lucky. And Minori walks in.
Those two are the worst influence on each other I could possibly imagine, Nana and Pops, because she offhandedly mentions things and he's just in immediately.
Yeah, Pops is in for anything anyone says at any point.
Yep.
And they jump up, and Nana immediately puts an apron on Minori. And
then they fuck off.
And Pops says, we're going to go buy stuff for the beach trip. Hold down the fort. Bye.
No explanation of what beach trip. No explanation of responsibilities or what should happen. Minori is not employed by Polpol that we know of officially.
We then cut to Shinjuku, and Ichijo is driving up, and we see that the police have barricaded off this area. He gets out of his car, walks up, and
is it just me, or did Buuro shit all over the car?
Yeah, there looks like white bird shit all over this cratered sedan.
Yes, this car has been caved in entirely, and yeah, it looks like it is covered from end to end in bird shit. But, you know, I imagine the pain of ripping off your own wing and crashing into the ground. He is a Gironki wearing a diaper. I did notice this. So incontinence is an issue.
For it to be that much, even post-diaper filling, is remarkable. That man was like 70% shit. Fuck.
We're talking way too much about bird shit.
You're right. But speaking of, we then immediately cut to the Garongi's hideout, and Burrow is sitting on a stool.
He has brought two stools and the entire collected works of Camus.
Yes. And Labarubidae comes up, and she's like, you managed to kill 126 people in 5 hours, but are you going to be able to finish your game? And Burrow's like, yeah, no. I will be healed by the time I finish reading Camus.
Sure.
Just for those of you who don't feel like doing the math, him killing 126 people means that he has killed 14 groups, since remember, he is doing them in groups of 9.
Yep.
He has 23 groups in total to do, so he's over halfway.
Mm-hmm. Which in 5 hours is pretty freaking impressive.
Yes. We then get a couple scenes of Hikaru morose walking around. And we also get Godai walking.
I heard like the Charlie Brown Christmas special music, just the da na na da na, as every time they're just wandering down an avenue.
Yes. Godai stops at a phone. We cut back to Popol. Minori answers and she has a quick conversation with Godai. And he's like, did you see a note? And she holds up a piece of paper with seagulls stuck to it and a note saying, Mr. Kenzaki will call.
God, it looks like he drew it with like either a large felt tip Sharpie or a black crayon.
So he quickly fills her in. Hey, I'm looking for this kid. When Mr. Kenzaki shows up, just tell him to stay there. I'll bring the child. And Sakurako comes in and she sees the note and she's like, oh, Mr. Kenzaki's coming. And Minori Sweet. Fills her in quickly.
I'd like to point out that, like, I'm assuming, I am willing to assume that the child was described in more detail off screen. However, based on the information we got on screen, Godai has nothing to go on over the fact that here is the area. There's a child wandering around. Bring him to me.
Maybe there is only one morose child allowed at a time.
In Japan?
Yes.
It's his week.
We cut from there to the joint task force, and I was right.
You were. Jared, tell him what the blowgun is and what it does. So,
they get the hospital reports.
I hate this so much.
And they find that the heart attacks have been caused by, effectively, owl pellets shot in through the shoulder, going down into the heart, and that's what causes the heart attack.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know, owls have a very weird particular digestive system because they can't digest bones, feathers, stuff like that. So when they eat their prey, after a certain amount of digestion, they throw up all of the stuff that they can't digest in order to preserve digestive room for everything else, which means you end up with these little pucks of basically like connective tissue, feathers, teeth,
bone,
beaks, yeah. You know, whatever they've eaten. So yeah, that is what is being fired fast enough to go through a person or, you know, crack the windshield of a helicopter. It penetrates the victim at the shoulder, makes its way into the bloodstream, into the heart, where it causes a heart attack. So they have pieces of bone and feather and beak and stuff in their heart.
Yes.
That's disgusting.
It's horrific.
It's almost worse than the car.
A side note, I may owe Nozomi an apology. She has not been as bad as I remember.
That's true. She hasn't been thirsting after Ichijo in the last several episodes.
Yeah, you set us up for obnoxious and slutty, and she's actually been kind of helpful.
It's nice to see character growth.
It was mostly off screen.
Yeah, like everything else in the show.
Tell, don't show, Jared.
In this show's case, it's neither show or tell.
It's true, it's just people writing about it elsewhere.
That's kind of funny. We are three people who, you know, do a lot of gesturing and prefer to show, not tell, doing a podcast about a show that prefers to tell, not show.
We cut to a station that you have been to.
Yeah, that was kind of cool. Like, I'm going to show this episode to my wife just because, like, I'm pretty sure we bought tickets for the train at that same, like, little kiosk. So that was kind of cool to see.
So we see Hikaru's going to buy a ticket to go home, and he stops. And Godai sees him, as, you know, luck would have it.
Godai sees an alone child and is like, maybe this time I'll grab the right one.
We don't know how many attempts it's been.
Headcanon, he's brought six kids back to Pol Pol, and they've been like, no, no, not that one, put it back.
Ikaru goes off in the opposite direction. Godai follows.
Godai gonna steal this kid.
He is. At the Garongi base, Buro has finished reading Camille. We aren't certain if it is just the one book or if he has finished the entire series. He brought the entire series with him.
He did. I brought the collected works of Camus. I'm going to read the collected works of Camus.
I have to mention the scene cuts as he slams the book shut.
Yes, it is a very cool scene transition of him snapping the book shut. And we're back at Pol Pol. And Sakurako Minori is sitting there when Mr. Kanzaki comes in. And he asks if he's heard anything from Godai. And Minori's like, yeah, he just called. He found him. He'll be bringing the child in soon.
The child.
And for these next two scenes, we're going to talk about them independently, but it does bounce back and forth between the two of them. It'd just be way too confusing to try and keep up with that.
Yeah.
So we get a temple, and Hikaru is there, and Godai comes up. It's like, hey, do you mind if I sit with you? Proceeds to sit down. He sits on one step and then, like, kind of looks over and adjusts to another step so that he's on the exact same eye level with the child.
Which is a shocking amount of self-awareness from Godai.
Godai shows a huge amount of emotional intelligence throughout this entire thing.
He's a min-maxed character. He's dumb as shit, but he understands what people are feeling.
He's a bard.
Yes. And he starts talking, and he leads off with, I was in fifth grade when I ran away from home. You know, it takes a lot of guts to do that. Kid kind of looks at him and goes like, you know, Mr. Kanzaki was my teacher too. He was worried about you. Wanted to, you know, help make sure that everything was okay. And he gives a first thumbs up. And Hikaru doesn't do anything. And goes like, oh, you know about the thumbs up, right? Mr. Kanzaki brought it up, how it was used in the Roman Empire.
The Roman Empire comes up again.
Yes. And he starts talking to Hikaru about, you were about to get on the train, go home and not worry about anything anymore, but you're not satisfied yet. And I get that. It's okay to be worried. You don't have to have things figured out. And Hikaru was like, I thought I did. I was gonna, you know, go to cram school, get into a good high school, make friends, have a great career. But it just feels meaningless now. And Godai's like, yeah, and that's okay. Be worried. Don't have this figured out. Don't try to have this figured out. Just go with where life takes you and try and be the best person you can be, wherever that ends up being.
I was honestly pretty shocked and actually really impressed with the conveyance of this message, like that it's okay to not be okay. It's okay to not have things figured out. And, like, this is something that we see a lot these days. I've got quite a friends who are teachers, and there have been, post-pandemic, a lot of behavioral problems from the kids in the age groups where they were going through, like, grade school when the pandemic happened, sent home. We have an entire generation of kids that learned all at the same time that the things that you thought were going to be constants in life are not guaranteed. It can all get taken away at any time, and you have no control over it. And that's a hard thing to face. It's a hard thing to come to grips with. As an adult, it's even harder as a kid. So you watch this kid who, like, his sense of normalcy and his peace has just been ripped away from him. That's a pretty vulnerable position to be in. And I was honestly really impressed with the writing of this episode, really impressed with how they handled that situation. And I was blown away.
While they're having this talk, again, like I said, it's cut between back at Pol Pol. Mr. Kanzaki is talking with Sakurako and Minori, and, you know, he's expressing, I'm upset that it took me so long to notice how upset Hikaru is, that kids these days are a bit harder to read, and that's really unfortunate because they seem to care more, they listen more, but they're also, they don't speak up, and they go on to a discussion that at first I kind of wanted to write off as just complaining about kids these days, but it's more, it's an indictment on at the time society, and it still kind of brought up, because Minori talks about how preschoolers are so energetic and individual, and that as kids get older, that just sort of seems to get beaten out of them, that they're more scared to be expressive because that makes them different, and they're taught to, you know, fit into the group, don't stand out. Mr. Kenzaki even brings up his fear about, you know, everywhere I see is just, don't worry, buy this, ignore your problems. And yeah, there is a certain thing to take from that. They're both very compelling discussions, and I'm in awe that they were in a program like this.
Especially with the target audience being, you know,
yeah, kids. These are messages that kids need to hear, and at least in Western programming, don't.
Nope.
Nothing like this would have happened in anything we watched as kids. Certainly not Masked Rider. But at the end of this, Godai gets an alert on the bike. Ichijo calls to say that they've found Buro, that he is back. And Ichijo looks at Hikaru and is like, I'm just going to be a minute. I got to go do a thing. We get Godai driving through the city. He transforms. We cut briefly to Ichijo in the car. And, oh, what a great scene this is.
I was very excited when this happened.
Because Ichijo rolls down his window, holds out his gun, and Godai comes driving by and just snatches it. It's such a cool handoff.
Absolutely.
As he's driving, Buro shows up, shoots at him. He gets off the bike. He goes into Rising Pegasus form, draws back, fires. We see Buro dodging at least the first few.
But good God, it's just a wave of, like, harpoons.
And he gets hit by it three.
Look like three, yeah.
He goes down, and in midair...
Oh, he doesn't go down, yeah. He explodes in the middle of the sky.
He starts to fall, and then he explodes, and the explosion continues.
Yeah, they give us a building for scale. There's like a skyscraper that he explodes above, and the explosion is bigger in terms of volume than the profile of the skyscraper.
Yeah, this is enormous.
Yeah, and Jetty was making the note, like, this is the power output of Rising Pegasus, so we're definitely hitting... actually just new tiers of destructive capability, both in terms of our villains and our heroes.
The size of these explosions are going to be plot relevant.
That's terrifying.
I would also like to point out that, yeah, it's just raining meat over the city right now.
I don't think there's any meat left.
There was a story of, I think it was Germany, where like a couple of farms for like a few weeks, it was just raining like blood, gore, and bits of viscera. And it came down to some, like, weird phenomenology of, like, vultures. Like, they had gotten startled and, like, vomited up recent meals. So it was just, like, meat falling out of the air like rain. And that's all I could think when I saw that explosion was just somewhere, someone just had, like, a toe land in there like teriyaki.
Ugh.
On that note.
It is the Monster Mash. The Monster
Mash. Ah, yes.
Well, you know he doesn't have a gag reflex. I'm not sorry.
Buro's monster form has some nappy-ass air. He's a wannabe intellectual and tries too hard to look cool in human form. He does have some pretty intense pain tolerance for some BDSM fun. But he seems like he'd try and tell you what you're doing wrong the whole time. He'd be insufferable. I'll pass.
God damn it, that's a terrifying notion. Somebody's being hypercritical in the bedroom. No, your angle's off by 13 degrees. Correct yourself or leave.
I'm sorry. I'm doing my best.
No, you're not.
Your best is an asshole. Not that way, but yep, also fair.
So as the explosion is happening...
Yeah, as Jetty's explosion goes off...
We cut to the temple, and Hikaru's there, and it... I don't know if it was intentional, but it is framed as if he can witness the explosion from where he is.
That explosion could be seen from space, bro.
We cut to a train station, and Godai and Hikaru walk up, and up ahead is Mr. Kenzaki, and they stop, and they just sort of stare at each other, and Hikaru finally gives a very low, very small thumbs up. And Mr. Kanzaki sees it and breaks out in the biggest smile. And Godai sees it and, like, looks at Hikaru and looks back up. And he smiles as well. And they move towards each other. End of episode.
The fact that Godai tried three thumbs up and just couldn't get there. And the kid saw Mr. Kanzaki. And then he got there with the thumbs up. Man.
It's like the three kicks to kill Jinoka.
Yeah, dude, I was thinking the same thing. Like, this is a different kind of battle. You gotta keep going, man.
So let's start off. What do we want to pick pellets. First?
Shit.
Yeah, pellets. I'm cool with that.
Pellets works.
All right, so we'll start off with Buro. Behavior. He's got the Gorongi level of arrogance. Yeah, he does have an intellectual thing about him that I haven't seen with any other Gorongi. He has a point. His arms are almost always crossed. At least one is crossed across his chest basically at all times. He has a self-preservation that we haven't seen in other Gorongi yet. The fact that he just knew to and went through with ripping his wing off to save his life. That's impressive. I wish we could have gotten a bit more in his human form just to get a good feel for his personality. Feel free to disagree. I would have liked to see more. I tend to feel that way with most of the Gorongi, though, as I would have liked to see more before they met their demise. I feel like a 3.5 is good for behavior. Design. So now that I think about it, I'm going to start with his human form. The leather suit doesn't really make a ton of sense. When he did his first appearance back in the previous set of episodes, I did not notice the little flaps to represent his wings.
Mm-hmm.
That was a cool touch, because at first I was like, there's nothing really here that indicates bird other than his glasses, which now that we know he's an owl, I feel like that makes sense. Even his intellectual side plays into the whole owls are wise.
Yeah, he's got those like Vash the Stampede circle glasses going on.
Yeah. His Gorongi design is interesting. It's a lot of brown, but there's a lot of intricate designs on his arms and chest.
Yeah.
The fact that he has a beak and teeth is terrifying.
You've never looked into a bird's open mouth, have you?
No, I have. Yeah, it's a horror show. It is a horror show. But this is slightly different, where we see that they are two distinct things. Here is the beak, here are the teeth. The use of a blowgun and the owl pets, which we'll get into in methodology, but still ties into the design of this Gorongi. Other than the color, I really like the design of this. I think I'm going to go with a 4. Methodology. This is the first one where we've seen, certainly we have established, the Go set their own terms. And his being, I'm going to kill them in groups of 9. It's the first time that we've seen something like that. Well, sure, we've seen Gorongi rampage and kill multiple people, but it's never simultaneously. And we get confirmation that these people are dying at exactly the same time. His use of owl pellets as his weapon of choice is disgusting and really effective. And you can see in the episode, the shock on people's faces is just 9 random bystanders go down. I'm interested to see how exactly this is going to work with the other Go, but certainly having set up, they will have their own unique methodologies that based off the terms of their game that they set for themselves. This is cool. I think this is setting a bar, so I can't give it like a 5 or anything, but I think, yeah, like another 4 for methodology.
So you got 4, 4.5, and 4?
Yeah. 3.5, 4, and 4.
Oh, 3.5, 4, 4.
So that brings me to a 3.8333 repeating pellets.
I mean, I'll go next. So my change in my rankings for this Grungy almost gave me whiplash. Because at first brush, I thought Hawk. We had that brown color scheme, you know, Hawk, Falcon would have made sense. But then once we connected that it was an owl form, a lot of other pieces fell into place. So I'm going to start with design. There were some stuff that you were absolutely correct in a lot of the ways that you discussed this character. Using the owl pellets through the blowgun, that was gross. It was also very thematic. Something you didn't mention that I thought was interesting, two of the other Grungy that flew showed up on their little radar. They mentioned Goma, they mentioned one other one, so it wasn't just Goma's...
Vagus.
Yeah, Vagus bot, yeah. So it wasn't just Goma that was emitting these signals or giving some sort of evidence of his passage, but they specified that this one was untrackable, which makes more sense with it being an owl, because owls don't produce sound when they fly. They're absolutely silent, and it's like a hallmark of their species. Him sitting, having the audacity to bring stools to the Grungy lair or to where they were all waiting so he could read his Nobel Prize winning French philosopher. That nodded owl intelligence, but also Grungy condescension. So, you know, you've got both. So I'm actually going to give him a 4. I felt like the human nods towards his design, once we connected owl, everything made sense. The character had a complete design aesthetic about them, both Grungy form and otherwise. And even though we have gone back to Dipey mode, even though there were some elements that were kind of drab, the hair is a little nappy, all in all, the presentation of this character was incredibly cohesive in a way that very few of other Grungy have come close to, I feel. So I'm going to give him a 4. Owl pellets. Yeah. Behavior, same thing. The behavior and the design for me were both very, very close to each other. They blended together, both in his behavior, like the reading of Camus as like a nod to owl intelligence. He showed up late, but wasn't bothered when they criticized him. So it's another one of these characters that wears that arrogance like a well-worn coat. Like it feels right for this character. Very, very strong character, very condescending. I'm going to give behavior a 4.5. And then method was very, very gross. Like, and I know I've blended through as I've spoken of these. I've touched on everything all the way back to going through design because I very much feel this character is that strong in terms of the cohesiveness of the design. The behavior and the method both blended together seamlessly. I'm actually going to give a 4 on method as well, which makes this one of my highest ranked Grungy at 4.16. The owl pellets.
Buuro's human form is pretty plain and boring. He at least has a cape for wings. His monster design is well executed, if uninspired. He has a functional mouth, usually a plus. He is again brown with a diaper though. There isn't really a whole lot to it, but what's there is good enough. A 3, I guess. His methodology is interesting but not showy enough. 9 people just having a heart attack out of nowhere would scary. He's also shooting his refuse, which is gross but at least owl-like. Like, I don't want to downplay how horrifying he is, but it isn't imaginative. Another 3. Behavior wouldn't being too noteworthy if wasn't for the badass wing rip. Otherwise he's aloof and cocky, not anything new. The weird intellectualism is a nice touch. Nothing really exciting. This will also get a 3. That's a 3 even owl pellets all around. A perfectly average monster.
So we disagree a little bit in our evaluations character, so yeah. That's kind of cool.
Something that I don't think we brought up, but I do feel like should mention about this.
What, shitting on the car?
No. Did you notice that the laws weren't talking down to him as much as other Garungis? Mm-hmm. They're like, are you sure you can finish? It wasn't the, you're going to fail if you don't get back up that they've done with all of the others. They show something approaching but not quite concern, and that's a thing that has not been given to another wounded Garungi.
Yeah. I've seen a whole lot of laughing in people's faces for sure, but yeah, you're absolutely correct.
Baruba does, Dildo doesn't say anything.
Yeah, it's almost like I don't know, I read it kind of as like begrudging respect, like you're of a level to where it wouldn't be appropriate for me to make fun of you, but like,
I don't know, it felt different
to me. It definitely did feel different, you're not wrong there.
But that then brings our composite score for Buro to a 3.666 repeating owl pellets. Episodes as a whole. So, plot. I'm going to be honest, when it clicked that this was going to be another set of morose child walking around episodes, I was not excited. But by the end of the second episode, I found myself more invested in the story than I thought I would be. And I think credit to the writers for having such a compelling message at the end and being able to tell it. It does, however, make the Garongi feel a little incidental. Like, oh, it's Kamen Rider, we have to have this. Which, for the first outing of a go, doesn't feel like it has the gravitas that it should. I guess we get that in the fact that we do see him hurt Godai in a way that he has not been hurt so far. But for turning my expectations around from actively not looking forward to this to being pleasantly surprised by the end, I'm going to give the plot 3.5. Cinematography. We got better flying CG than we have had in some other episodes. The CG on the Rising Bowgun is about to be expected when we show the transformation. Honestly, the physical prop of it looks really cool.
It's a Vikavolt.
Yeah. A Vikavolt as a gun. I'm not as thrilled on the look of Rising Pegasus as a whole. The gold popped so much better against Titan's purple than it does this green. And while, like, the shoulders also changed on Titan some, it didn't here, it just got trimmed. And while I liked the asymmetry, I would have liked to have seen more of the armor shift as well. It's a personal thing here, I suppose. We got some really cool overheads of Tokyo. The transition of Buro snapping the book shut was great. The Hogwarts Express-esque changing of scenery while on the train. You know, there's a reason a theme park attraction has done the same thing. It's effective. There's no real, like, wow moments of cinematography for me. So, I think a 3. Combat. I, in the past, have liked Pegasus and haven't been as upset with the finisher or the fight as, you know, say, like, you have, Jed. But I felt it this time. The first fight on the rooftop at the end of episode 25 was cool. Yusuke being off his footing the entire time, having to dodge, roll around, finally gets up to make the shot, and then he gets hit and goes down. That was cool. That's something that we haven't quite seen. But we can't even call episode 26 a fight. It was just shot and done. And while I like it a bit more with you saying that the explosions become plot relevant and that we're seeing the scale of power, I don't know. I would have liked to have seen more. I feel let down by this, to have seen Buro be effective, to be able to keep Kuga off of his footing, and then he just went down like a chump. And to see the first go down like a chump feels wrong. It was like we were back with some of the zoo. And I'm not thrilled about that. I think I've got to go with like a 2 for combat. So with a 3.5, a 3, and a 2, that brings me to a 2.8. 3.333 repeating.
We're eventually going to be able to do these quick maths in our head. 2.833. So I'm going to go ahead and give you the spoilers. All three of my scores for this episode came in at a 3.5 because for me, these two episodes, you pointed out something that I actually did want to go into and flesh out. These episodes felt kind of min-maxed for me because You're absolutely correct. The plot, like, I was straight up like, oh my God, here we go again with the, you know, Charlie Brown Christmas special, child wandering through Tokyo, taking different transit systems. And that, for what it was, didn't impress me. We've seen it before. However, when we get to the end and we have those two sets of dialogues, the one between Godai and the kid and between the three adults and Polpol, both of those sets of conversations were a payout that far outweighed the setup. So for these episodes, the plot was very min-maxy in that, as a rule, as we went through, there was a whole lot that I just didn't care about, couldn't be bothered with, but the payout for it was really cool. So I'm giving the plot a 3.5 because that's the really, really strong dialogue and the really, really poignant social commentary were kind of balanced against what was otherwise following a kid around a city for 40 minutes and then a couple of bird fights. So 3.5 there. Cinematography, same 3.5, just because while we did have some very good scenes, the flying CGI was absolutely better. The helicopter needed a little bit of work here and there. We had superimposed a helicopter on a couple of scenes to make it look like we're watching kind of from Ichijo's perspective, but the stark contrast between the very close helicopter CGI and the very far away building that was much crisper in detail didn't, you know, quite strike. There were, again, like you said, the snapping of the book as a scene transition. You know, we had very, very cool individual moments balanced against, I hesitate to use the word mediocrity, but there wasn't anything special about a lot of it until there was. So 3.5 there. Fights, exact same thing. We watched Godai get hit and go down. We watched a character keep Godai off his game long enough for him to actually hit him. We watched a character put the hurting on Godai so hard that if he hadn't also taken a glancing shot to the wing, would have probably ended our main character. Godai's hit in the arm, he's hit in the leg, he goes down, and as his last little thing, he, you know, throws up the weapon and fires off a burst, clips the wing. But that's the end of Godai if he'd missed. Like, this thing can penetrate armor, it can clearly penetrate Godai. So, like, all he's... Shut up, Jetty. So all he's got to do is refocus, and he can kill our protagonist. So while, yes, as overall the fights felt a little anemic, we had some really cool moments. The Grongi having either the self-awareness, instinct, or knowledge to rip off his own wing to prevent his imminent demise. You know, the selection of targets. We had, you said it, I said it, you know, keeping the main character's tension off his game so he can't actually properly transform. We had a whole lot of mediocrity, or as the fights go, not much mediocrity, offset by some individual very cool moments. Now, Jetty's told us that the larger explosions will have some ramifications. I personally, Pegasus isn't your favorite. I really do like Pegasus, and the Rising Pegasus multi...
Pegasus. Titan is my absolute favorite, yeah. But I like Pegasus.
Like, the multi-shot railgun is freaking cool. It reminded me, I don't know if you guys ever played Fear. There's an old...
played one of the Fears.
Yeah, it's an old first-person shooter, and one of the most powerful guns in the game was, I think it was called, like, the XV-8 Penetrator. Yeah, joke all you want to, but it was meant to deal with things that needed to be killed with stakes. So it was basically a rifle railgun, and it fired, like, 12-inch long steel spikes. And these reminded me of that, and they had kind of the same gravitas. Like, this is a powerful weapon. Like, nobody in our villains roster would have stood a chance against this thing earlier in the series. So, you know, 3.5, which, I mean, makes my math easy. 3.5s averages out to 3.5.
The episode is another morose walking. It takes a bit too much of the runtime, but I like this a bit more than Mika for some reason.
Yeah.
The moral of that storyline is interesting, and not what I thought they were going for. The show gets into the weeds on the education discussion, but it was very touching. I love seeing the police not being able to help. It really highlights what they usually provide for Godai. It's not outstanding, but I do like it. 3.5. Cinematography in these episodes is pretty good. I love the Grongi lair shots, especially the introductions to all the new Go. There's a really good moment where Buro shuts a book and the show immediately cuts to another scene. I really like the overhead city shots. And the philosophy scenes are dynamically shot so that they aren't boring. A very solid technical episode. a 4 out of 5. The fight has all of my problems with Pegasus form fights. The bow gun is a cool weapon, but not much is done with it. I will say that Rising Titan bodied Garima, but Rising Pegasus struggled with the go, even getting hit. So that's a nice show of escalation. But otherwise this is not a fight for my sensibilities. I won't be too harsh for that cause it's fine for what it is. I'll give it a 3. That's a 3.5 owl pellets total.
3.27666666666
pellets.
Pellets. So our overall scores for this were positive, trending positive. Yeah, like, I really enjoyed this villain. I enjoyed these episodes. We all pointed it out, but there was some interesting pacing stuff to address in these episodes. Like, the flow of these episodes, the payouts were awesome. The journey, maybe not so much.
Yeah. We do get, effectively, the whole ends up being more than the sum of its parts.
It generally is. I'm sorry, that was weak. I'll do better.
Anything else we really want to say about this? All right.
Well, I think that's it, boys.
In that case, join us next week when we'll be watching episodes 27 and 28, Ripple and Clarification.
You can reach us by email at commentarytrack@gmail.com or on Twitter at commentarytrack. You can support us at patreon.com/thecommentarytrack. Just $5 a month, you can get access to monthly bonus episodes. Going up, hopefully, alongside this episode is our coverage of the first two episodes of Sabin's Masked Rider. Merry Christmas. Koala Granji.
I know you have personal antipathy towards koalas. How recently has it been fed? Oh, an hour ago. Okay, it's safe. Oh, he hangry? Nah, we out.
It has chlamydia.
Of course it does.
Not what I mean. Not what I meant at all.
It's too late. It's out there.
I'm moving us forward.